After resonating with the way and arousing the aspiration for enlightenment, take refuge in the great way of Buddha ancestors and devote yourself to the practice of way-seeking mind. Even if you have not yet aroused the way-seeking mind, follow the examples of Buddha ancestors who did arouse the way-seeking mind in former times. Words from 13th century Japanese Soto Zen founder Ehe Dogen. Dogen reminds us that Zen practice is embedded within a long ancestral history in which we take refuge, connect, and commit. And he also advises following the examples of these ancestors to arouse way-seeking mind or bodhicitta, the natural aspiration to follow a path leading to truth, goodness, and awakening. Today, I'd like to explore with you how moment-to-moment practice that is in relationship with both Buddhist ancestors and fellow contemporary practitioners can be an important source of what Joanna Macy calls active hope, especially when present causes and conditions give rise to discouragement and alienation. Several of you have encountered some of Dogen's fascicles or chapters in translations of his Kana Shobogenzo, wherein he cautions against the conceptual reification or taking as real of any fixed ideas regarding an independent, separate self, body and mind, that our cultural and developmental history has conditioned. Over the past weeks, I've experienced how such ideas of separation can insidiously arise, manifesting as alienation, both from larger groups within which I'm situated, and sometimes even from the familiar comfort of sensing this very body-mind as an impermanent, integral aspect of one larger, interconnected, complex process. Witnessing the magnitude of conflagrations in Southern California, consequent in substantial part to the societal minimization, sometimes even denial, of a global climate crisis, as well as observing the current intentional cruelty of a politics of authoritarian oligarchy, it has felt difficult to recall the sense of belonging that comes with shared values and cause among fellow citizens. For me, such periods of alienation are times of unease and often of a conceptual spinning of future-focused mind. What will happen next? Will remaining constitutional guardrails be sufficient to constrain the worst of vindictive, homophobic, transphobic, misogynistic, and xenophobic political impulses? Will there be any accountability for harmful, lawless actions? What responsibility do I have as a national and global citizen? These questions might all seem to be reasonable and justified. And yet I'm also aware of how my preoccupation with such conceptual spinning creates anxious imbalance, potentially biasing toward a reactivity that is far from the equanimous poise necessary for skillful and compassionate response. This awareness, even when only a glimmer in consciousness, leads me back to practice. In the silence and stillness of Zazen, I gradually relearn how to allow mind, like a cloudy glass of water at rest, to settle and clear. Attention can then become more pliant and stable, more readily and easily remaining wherever intention places it. This allows arising sensations, perceptions, feelings, and thoughts to be experienced as the impermanent and interdependent formations of body-mind world that they are. No independent, separate self creates or owns these passing phenomena. There is only ever-changing process that conditioning has led to separating and categorizing into this and that, self and other, past, present, and future, body and mind. With continuing practice, reified categories, including those of self, body, and mind, can at least sometimes drop away. In a Shobogenzo fascicle, Dogen wrote, "In Zazen, you invariably drop away body and mind, cut through fragmented concepts and thoughts from the past, and realize essential Buddha Dharma." Dropping away of body and mind is the letting go of fixed concepts of self that are at the root of reactivity. As we try to enhance, protect, and defend this constructed self, interpreting events as either threats or affordances. And as we practice Zazen, whether at home in a meditation hall, online with others, or perhaps even traveling to different practice places, this dropping away of self, body, and mind becomes the shared process in which non-separation of self and other is the actualization of our inherent Buddha nature and the entirety of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Again from Dogen in that same Shobogenzo passage from which I just quoted. You cultivate Buddha activity at innumerable practice places of Buddha Tathagatas everywhere. Provide the opportunity for everyone to engage in ongoing Buddhahood and vigorously uplift the Dharma of going beyond Buddha. The second part of that sentence I just read seems particularly interesting. Provide the opportunity for everyone to engage in ongoing Buddhahood and vigorously uplift the Dharma of going beyond Buddha. When we actualize together our inherent interdependent Buddha nature in innumerable places of Buddhist practice, this isn't done to serve the uplifting of a club, tribe, or cult. Rather, it's done to embody and enact the constantly changing relational interdependence that goes beyond any concepts of Buddha and Buddhism. This is the Dharma of dropping away all ideas of body, mind, self, and Buddha that we vigorously uplift in practice. Although this way of framing Zen practice may at first sound abstractly philosophical, it could not be more pragmatic and grounded in moment-by-moment direct experience. Practice is pragmatic in that it is praxis, something we do together, not a set of beliefs we adopt. Practice also doesn't have to take on only one particular form. Of course, there is the fully embodied presence of Zazen, sitting meditation. And there is also the fully embodied presence of gardening, of cooking, of cleaning, of cuddling a grandchild, niece, or nephew, of being with a sick friend or family member, and of offering grateful prayer in mosque, temple, church, or home. We don't engage practice for the benefit of self or identity group alone. Rather, as we commit in the first of the four Bodhisattva vows chanted together at the end of our meetings, we practice for the liberation from suffering of all the numberless beings that exist, past, present, and future. In this aspiration, together as interdependent parts of the one body, we awaken from the delusion of being only an independent self that was born, gets sick, grows old, and dies. Dogen put it this way: with the body and mind that migrate through birth and death, you should arouse the aspiration for enlightenment to awaken others first. Even if you spare your body and mind from the way of arousing the aspiration for enlightenment in the course of birth, aging, sickness, and death, you cannot in the end keep them as your own possessions. We're in this together, none excluded. We share with all Buddhas and sentient beings, all selfless servants and vengeful tyrants, this course of what we call birth, aging, sickness, and death. And we are all by nature beings who, throughout birth, aging, sickness, and death, are in relationship. As infants, without the nurturing bond with a parental figure, we don't survive and mature. In aging, without the kindness of those who offer help with what we can no longer do alone, we don't thrive. In sickness, without the compassionate ministrations of family, friends, and healthcare professionals, we don't heal. And in death, without the gentle presence and unintrusive loving care of those who come alongside, we are unable to transition peacefully. At times, we may think of Sangha as being separate from Buddha and Dharma, sometimes a comforting and supportive bonus to practice, sometimes an irritating abrasion. Yet, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are only words that artificially divide an integrated wholeness that is spiritual practice. Some of you are likely familiar with the story told in the Pali Canon of the Buddha and his younger cousin and attendant Ananda, enjoying a pleasant walk together on the Indo-Gangetic plain. Ananda, likely sensing the comfort of his warm relationship with the Tathagata, remarks, "It seems to me that spiritual friendship is fully half of the holy life." Hearing this, the Buddha replies, "Do not say that, Ananda. Spiritual friendship is the whole of the holy life." We find practice and give rise to way-seeking mind in relationship with teachers and other practitioners. And even when sitting zazen alone, we remain in relationship that is always there, though sometimes not consciously noticed. In each present moment of zazen, we observe the arising and passing away of various contents of the mental continuum. What we are observing is relationality. For the processes of giving rise to any mental formation are conditioned by interactions of mind-body world with other beings, past, present, and future, human and more than human, sentient and allegedly insentient. And when we practice off the cushion or chair, and into engagement with all the world that is calling out for compassionate attention, We sustain active hope in the relationships of beloved community. Importantly, as we've discussed before, beloved community includes our human and more than human relationships. The stillness and silence of wholehearted practice allows us to better notice the wide variety of these relationships and can give rise to a gratitude and respect that is essential for the survival of all life on this planet. Some of you may be familiar with the history of a Native American Iroquois Confederacy delegation who participated in a 1977 United Nations conference in Geneva, Switzerland. Their presentation to this conference included a basic call to consciousness that contained the following statement. The original instructions direct that we who walk about on the earth are to express a great respect, an affection, and a gratitude toward all the spirits which create and support life. We give a greeting and thanksgiving to the many supporters of our own lives, the corn, beans, squash, the winds, the sun. When people cease to respect and express gratitude for these many things, then all life will come to an end. When the silence and stillness of practice liberates the experience of respect and gratitude, my sense of alienation can heal. And I can again be aware of the many compassionate beings, seen and unseen, with whom I'm in relationship, offering care and receiving care, mutually supporting the poised equanimity that grounds skillful, loving response rather than reaction. In a recent email note, Insight Meditation Society co-founding teacher Jack Kornfield wrote, "Difficult times call on our best spirit. We must remind ourselves that in uncertain times, our own steadiness can become a sanctuary for others. Like the strings of a violin being played will resonate with another nearby on a table, our resonance of peaceful stillness and steadiness spreads out in every direction, touching the hearts of all beings near and far, that they might find a deeper quiet, a loving presence." The children's bodhisattva, Mr. Rogers, describes how his mother taught him to see the disasters of the world in a new way. Instead of focusing just on the tragedy and loss, look for the helpers. Expand your gaze to take in all the people who are rushing in from all sides to offer their care, assistance, and support. Amidst the hard times, let yourself see the wave of compassion that arises around the suffering, the human heart that cannot be stopped. So, I'll close this talk with two more brief quotes. The first is a reminder from Ehe Dogen that continuous practice is always right here, right now. He wrote, "Moment by moment, a thought appears and disappears without abiding. Moment by moment, a body appears and disappears without abiding. Yet the power of practice always matures." The second, from contemporary American Lama Rod Owens, is a reminder that amid the chaos and horror of wars, the consequences of an ongoing climate crisis, and a politics of self-glorification, revenge, and cruelty. Moment by moment, continuous practice accepts all, excludes nothing and no one, and remains engaged. Lama Rad said, "Face the chaos. Let your heart break. Ask to be cared for. Be uncomfortable. Accept everything as it arises. Then do the work to change what needs to be changed." Gassho, now please share your observations and questions.